Well, friends, I wonder what people say when you ask them what they think of Jesus. A very common answer that I get is that Jesus was a great moral teacher. And it's actually a very safe response to say that. And people who say this often go on to say, well, Buddha was a great moral teacher too, or Muhammad was, or the Dalai Lama is, even though the morals they taught and the lives they lived were very different. It's a safe option because if Jesus was simply a teacher, then there's nothing much that's required by us in response to him. Now, in a sense, Jesus clearly was a profound teacher. Heath showed us that last week when we looked at some of Jesus' parables. But to view Jesus merely as a teacher, even a great teacher, just doesn't do justice to the Bible's teaching. The Bible tells us a lot more about who Jesus is and why he came. And Mark's gospel tells us a lot more about who Jesus is and about how we should respond to Jesus. And in today's passage, we learn that Jesus is God who rescues helpless people from disaster and destruction. In fact, Jesus is God who rescues you and me from disaster and destruction. Well, we're picking up the story from verse 35, and it's the evening, and Jesus has spent the entire day teaching the crowds from a boat on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. And at the end of his teaching session, he explained the parables to his own disciples. And then what does Jesus do at the end of a day's full teaching? Well, he doesn't go home to rest. No, he enlists his disciples and heads away from home, towards the other side of the sea, the eastern side. Perhaps he'll rest over there. But quite likely, actually, he wants to go to preach the gospel there as well. Remember, back in chapter 1, verse 38, Jesus said, "Let us go to the next towns, that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And so Jesus and his disciples set off in the boat, and probably a larger group of disciples went rather than just the 12, since there were other boats as well. We see that in verse 36. Now, I don't know if you've ever taken a boat cruise in the evening, but it actually can be a very pleasant experience, very relaxing, especially if you've had a long, hard day. Well, I'm not sure how this cruise started, but it's not long before there are serious problems. And we're told in verse 37 that a great windstorm arose, literally a mega storm. And in fact, the Sea of Galilee was renowned for these hurricane-like storms, and it still is today. These storms can spring up very quickly, and that's what's happening here. And the storm whipped up dangerous waves which were breaking into the boat. Now, the boat probably was about 4.5 feet high and about 8 metres long and about 2 metres wide. So a reasonable size boat, but not huge. And it could hold 15 people. And here, the waves are breaking and this boat is starting to fill. So this is a very dangerous situation. These men will sink and probably drown if something doesn't change very soon. And the disciples understand their situation is very, very dire. In fact, verse 38 tells us that they understand themselves to be actually in the process of perishing, of dying. So they're very afraid. In fact, they're scared to death, we see in verse 40. But very strangely, while his disciples are panicking, Jesus is sound asleep. He's very much at peace. Now, of course, that's not natural. It's not normal. In fact, it's supernatural. And it reminds me of a couple of years ago, I was coming back from Tassie on the Spirit of Tasmania, and it was very wild weather, and Bass Strait was terribly rough that night. And I could barely sleep. I was inside in a weatherproof cabin, away from the cold and the waves and the wind, and I was in a much bigger ship than a little wooden fishing boat, and yet I could barely sleep. But here, in the midst of this hurricane, Jesus is sound asleep. So they wake him. "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Verse 38. They address him as teacher, and they want to enlist him and his help in this predicament. So perhaps they were expecting Jesus to grab a bucket and start bailing, but that's not what he does. No, astoundingly, in verse 39, we're told that he rebukes the wind. He says to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the word used for rebuked is the same word that Jesus has already used when he rebuked evil spirits in chapter 1 and chapter 3. And he rebuked the wind, and the rebuked wind ceases, and the wind obeys Jesus. So friends, this is an event that really actually happened. Jesus orders the howling gale to stop, and it stops. And Jesus also orders the sea to stop raging and to be still. And the word used means to be still and to stay still. And so there's a great calm. Whereas there had been a great windstorm, now there's a great calm. Jesus has merely to speak a few words to the chaotic elements, to the wind and the sea, and the chaos is gone. It's clear from the text that the great calm occurs precisely because Jesus speaks to the elements. Hurricane-force winds and raging seas are both stopped dead in their tracks at the mouth of Jesus. Now, that's extraordinary. Now, the disciples had clearly feared for their lives, afraid that they were going to drown, but now the sea is dead calm and the wind has stopped and the danger has passed. So surely there's no need to be afraid now. But in verse 40, we see that they're still afraid. Jesus says to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And in verse 41, we see that just as the boat had been filling with water, now these disciples are filled with great fear. And this is a fear that's not caused by a close encounter with death, because that danger's past, but this is a fear that's caused by a close encounter with something else, with someone else. These disciples have seen and heard Jesus command the elements to do his bidding, and they've seen the elements absolutely and immediately obey Jesus. Previously, they'd seen Jesus as a teacher. They've been referring to him as teacher, but it's becoming very clear that he's much, much more. Previously, they've seen Jesus cast out demons and heal the sick, but it's clear that he's much, much more than a travelling wonder worker. You see, these are devout Jews. They're monotheists, and they understand that there's only one being who absolutely controls all the elements of nature by his word, who can bring order and calm out of chaos by his word. The same one who actually, by his word, brought creation order out of chaotic disorder at the beginning in Genesis 1. God himself. So the disciples, in fear, ask the question, "Who then is this that even wind and sea obey him?" Now, none of them answers that question out loud, but their answer is implied. They know very well who this must be. This Jesus can only be God in their midst, the Almighty Creator God in a boat with them. This is an awesome moment. Jesus is God among them, and they're filled with the fear of the Lord. Well, in chapter 5, Jesus and his disciples land on the eastern side of the sea, and they land at a place called Gerasa or Gergesa, and this was an outlying village of the Decapolis. Now, the Decapolis was a group of 10 cities that the Romans had won back from the Jews in 63 BC. And the Romans had re-established these 10 cities as showcase centres of pagan religion. They were actually spiritually very dark places. They were centres of occult religious practices. So for the Jews, the region of the Decapolis was unclean. And as soon as Jesus and his disciples land, they're met by a very tragic, troubled man. He has an unclean spirit. That is, he's demon afflicted, and he lives in an unclean place among the tombs. He's a dangerous, deranged man. And many times people have tried to restrain him in chains, verse 4, but he just tore the chains apart and broke the locks. And no person had the strength to control him. He's like the Incredible Hulk, or like Mr. Hyde from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Except they're fairy tales, but this man is a living nightmare. He's a danger to himself. We're told, verse 5, night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. He's demon-afflicted and insane. He's actively doing himself physical harm, and he's tormented in mind and soul, crying out day and night. So this man is a tragic picture of deranged and distorted and despairing humanity. This man, created in the image of God, is being destroyed by demonic forces and now more resembles a feral animal than a rational human being. So when this man with the unclean spirit sees Jesus, he falls at his feet. And this is actually an admission by the man of the reverence that's due to Jesus. And Jesus immediately recognizes what's going on. Jesus, the one who is God in a person, recognizes it when he sees evil personified. He recognizes this demonic affliction. Look at verse 8. He says, "Come out of him, you unclean spirit." Now the disciples in the boat, when they'd seen Jesus calm the storm, asked, "Who then is this?" And the implied answer was, "This is God amongst us." Well, here we see a much more explicit answer to the question, "Who is Jesus?" Here the demon-afflicted man identifies Jesus explicitly as Son of the Most High God. In fact, it's actually the unclean spirit speaking through the man who identifies Jesus. And the unclean spirit pleads with Jesus not to torment him. So Jesus asked the unclean spirit, "What is your name?" Effectively, he's saying, "What sort of spirit are you?" And the unclean spirit's reply, it's a chilling reply. He says, "My name is Legion, for we are many." That's a disturbing answer. You see, the word legion referred to the largest sized troop regiment of the Roman army. And a legion could actually be several thousand troops. So in this man, there's a concentration of many evil, unclean spirits, and they're actively destroying him. And now this legion of many demons cowers before one man, Jesus. They beg not to be tormented by this one man, not to be driven from the region. The legion begs for Jesus' permission to enter the herd of pigs on the hillside. And Jesus gives that permission. And the unclean spirits leave the tormented man and enter the 2,000 pigs. And the pigs go berserk and stampede down the hill into the sea, where they drown. You'd have to say a pretty bad result for the pigs. But the man with that the demons come out of, that's a very different story. He's wonderfully restored to sanity and wholeness. So in verse 15, we find him sitting at Jesus' feet, clothed and in his right mind. And the most important thing to notice in this episode is the contest between Jesus and the demons. And in fact, it's no contest at all, and we must grasp this. Friends, we must get our theology from the Bible and not from Hollywood or from films like The Exorcist. So in those films, they incorrectly portray God and Satan as sort of equal and opposite foes. But that's not right, and it's not true. According to the Bible, God is not a created being, but is eternal, and he's perfectly good and all-knowing and all-powerful. But Satan is not eternal, he is created, and he's evil. Satan's cunning, but he's not all-knowing, and he's not all-powerful. And neither are those evil, unclean spirits who do Satan's bidding. So friends, when God faces off with unclean spirits, with demons, it's not as if it's a contest between equally matched opponents, as if the battle could go either way. No, when God faces off with unclean spirits, the outcome is assured. It's a lay-down Messiah. God will triumph, no question. So as we've seen in this passage, when Jesus confronts the legion of demons, there's absolutely no contest. Because in Jesus, the demons have come face to face with God. They've acknowledged him as Son of the Most High God, the one with authority and power and prerogatives of God. Well, friends, so far we've seen Jesus rescue his disciples from disaster and destruction at sea. And we've seen Jesus rescue the demon-afflicted man from disaster and destruction on the land. And in doing so, we've seen the answer to the question, who is Jesus? We've seen that Jesus is God who rescues helpless people from disaster and destruction. So the question is, how should people therefore respond to Jesus? And in this passage, we see two responses to Jesus, and the first is in verses 14 to 17. Now the herdsmen, unfortunately, are now unemployed. They no longer have pigs to look after, and so instead they flee. And that's understandable. It must have been very confronting to see all those pigs madly plunging to their death. So the herdsmen ran from the scene and broadcast the news of what's happened wherever they went, in the city and in the countryside. And people from all over the place come to see for themselves, and they find Jesus with the formerly demon-afflicted man sitting at his feet. And the man is completely changed. He's sitting calmly, still, not having to be restrained. He's clothed, whereas the demon-afflicted often went about naked. So he's clothed and is in his right mind. So the insanity has gone. This man, who had resembled a feral animal, now looks much more like he was designed to be, a rational, composed human being. And that, of course, is a wonderful thing, a thing to rejoice over. Rejoicing because a deranged man has been restored. Rejoicing because the man would no longer be an unpredictable, dangerous threat to the community. But the people who come out to see, they don't rejoice. Instead, we're told in verse 15, they're afraid. And they start begging Jesus to leave the area. They reject Jesus and they want nothing to do with him. And we're not told why this is the case. But we have seen that these people live in a region which was a stronghold of great spiritual darkness. So perhaps these people are so affected by this darkness that they want nothing to do with Jesus, the one who personifies perfect spiritual light. And in fact, elsewhere in the New Testament, Jesus talks about people who react to him in this way. So in John 3, verse 19 and 20, Jesus says, "This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, but people love darkness rather than the light because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed." Or perhaps their motives for wanting Jesus to leave are economic. You see, Jesus, in casting out the demons, has caused huge economic loss to the owners of the pigs. Perhaps if Jesus remains, he'll upset the whole economy in a similar way. Yep, it's probably best for the economy if Jesus leaves. That's enough reason to reject Jesus. And in fact, Jesus himself certainly anticipates that love of money, love of financial security, and the deceitfulness of wealth are reasons why people reject him and his kingdom in his day and in our day too. So, friends, many of the locals who heard or who saw or heard about how Jesus had wonderfully saved this demon-afflicted man nonetheless begged Jesus to leave them and the area. The people would rather remain in spiritual darkness than submit to Jesus and receive spiritual light. And friends, there are many, many people like that today, people who tragically continue to reject Jesus. But friends, in verses 18 to 20, we see a completely different response to Jesus. So Jesus here is indeed leaving the area. He's doing what the locals begged him to do. But the man rescued from the demons now begs to be with Jesus. Previously, the demon speaking through this man had cried, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" They had wanted nothing to do with Jesus, but now that he's cleansed from those demons and in his right mind, this man begs to be with Jesus. He's been saved and changed and restored by Jesus. And having been found by Jesus, he doesn't want to let Jesus go. But here, friends, Jesus is still completely in control. So Jesus, who had given permission to the demons to go into the pigs, withholds permission from this man. He doesn't permit him to come with him. Instead, he sends him on a special mission. He sends the man back home to rejoin his friends and to testify of the Lord's mercy to him and his saving work for him. So here Jesus is saying clearly that in his ministry to the man, the Lord has been working. God has been working. And in rescuing a man from disaster and destruction at the hands of demons, just like he rescued his disciples from disaster and destruction at sea. And the freed man knew that Jesus was doing the works of God, so he goes back to the Decapolis. Jesus told him to share what the Lord had done, so this man proclaims what Jesus has done. That is, the man preached Jesus as the one who does the work of God, in fact, that Jesus is God. And as a result, in verse 20, we see that many who heard were amazed. They marvelled. So friends, not everyone from the region of the Decapolis was close to Jesus and to what God was doing in Jesus. Certainly some locals had begged him to leave, but many people marvelled. So friends, today we've thought about who Jesus is. We've acknowledged that Jesus is a teacher, but we've seen that Jesus is much, much more than simply a teacher, more than even a great moral teacher. Friends, today's passage teaches us fundamentally that Jesus is God who rescues helpless people from disaster and destruction. Now, today in our culture, it's very respectable and very conventional to nod your head and agree that Jesus was a great moral teacher. That's a safe opinion, a predictable opinion, and an opinion that won't get you any aggro from anyone. And friend, perhaps that's the way you like to think of Jesus, as a great teacher. Not less, but not more. But today we've seen that that's a completely inadequate assessment of Jesus. Convenient, but inadequate. No, Jesus is God who rescues helpless people from disaster and destruction. And friend, Jesus is God who can rescue you from disaster and destruction. You see, although we're not drowning at sea right now, and although we may not be afflicted with a horde of demons, as human beings, we're naturally at great risk of disaster and destruction. The destruction of eternal death, eternal separation from God in hell. We all naturally face the disaster and destruction of hell because of our sin. And we're helpless to do anything about it. We cannot make up for our sin ourselves. We need rescuing. And friend, Jesus is the one who rescues us by his death on the cross. Jesus is God who rescues us from the disaster and destruction our sins deserve. But friend, it's not enough to accurately know who Jesus is, that he's more than a great moral teacher. It's important to act upon who Jesus is. In today's passage, we saw some who, though they saw the power of God in Jesus, nonetheless reject Jesus, preferring to live lives without Jesus, begging him to go away and leave them alone. And he did. They rejected Jesus, and in so doing, they rejected God. But the man who'd been demon-afflicted had a completely different response to Jesus. He was shown mercy by Jesus and was freed by demons. But that wasn't all. He also, in response, welcomed Jesus, seeking friendship with Jesus, and was ultimately sent on mission by Jesus. So from today's passage, we see that Jesus is God who rescues helpless people from disaster and destruction, especially from hell. And since Jesus is God, Jesus requires a response from you. The question is, are you going to be like the freed man? Will you welcome Jesus, seek friendship with Jesus, become a disciple of Jesus? Will you call out to God, confessing that you've been wrong to ignore Jesus and wrong to live life your own way rather than living to please God? And friend, if you will call out in faith to God, then know this, he certainly will hear you and will forgive your sins and will rescue you from eternal disaster. And what's the alternative? Well, it's too terrible to contemplate. The alternative is to be like the comfortable people who ventured out to see a freed man sitting at Jesus' feet and then rejected Jesus. But those who reject Jesus, friends, will fail to receive Jesus' help when they need it most. Friend, if you reject Jesus, you won't have anyone to rescue you from the eternal disaster of hell. You'll be on your own, facing God's judgment on your own, with no one to rescue you. But many of us this morning have welcomed Jesus as our rescuer, the one who rescues us from disaster and destruction. And how should we respond to today's passage? Well, we should be like the rescued man. Jesus sent him to tell his friends about what the Lord had mercifully done for him. Likewise, as people who've been rescued and who are trusting in Jesus, we also have been shown incredible mercy by God. We also should tell our friends about God's mercy. We should take opportunities to share the saving gospel message of Jesus with our friends and family and others, so that they too might receive God's mercy by trusting in Jesus. That through Jesus, they too might be saved from eternal destruction and disaster. So friends, let's pray about these things now.